This is Spiro Rondos for Concordia University. With us today is Joanna Brzezowska, Associate Professor in Design and Computation Arts at Concordia University in Montreal. She is a member of Hexagram Research Institute and founder and research director of ExtraSoft Labs, where her team develops innovative methods and applications in electronic textiles and responsive garments. She has degrees in pure mathematics and fine arts, as well as a Master of Science degree from MIT. Also with us is Hal Myers, co-founder and president of Thought Technology, the world's leading producer of biofeedback hardware and software. These tools are used in the healthcare field, high performance, sports training, mental health, and ergonomics. Hal Myers is an electrical engineer with a PhD in experimental medicine from McGill. His initial research focused on the use of biofeedback to control pain. Welcome to you both. So let's begin with Joanna Brzezowska. Tell us a little bit about electronic textiles and responsive garments. What are they?
So I started Access Labs about 10 years ago to develop softer computers. That was my initial desire when I entered into this field. I was working in the US before. I had a company called International Fashion Machines where we wanted to embed simple electronics into soft surfaces. We were working, for example, with companies like Nike to make sneakers that could generate their own power and change color depending on how fast you were running. These days, I focus a lot more on what's called the cultural industry. So I develop electronic textiles that can change shape, can change color, can perhaps sense the proximity of people in the environment, and then contribute to some greater cultural production. So these textiles, for instance, can be used in dance performances where dancers walk up to them and then the textile senses the presence of the dancer and changes the light in the room or the music in the room. Or, for example, textiles can hang on a wall and just slowly change color over time without glowing, without emitting light, just slowly change their colors. We also, of course, apply this research to body-worn textiles in the form of garments. So we develop a lot of reactive garments or interactive garments that include electronic components. An example of that would be, for example, the scorpion dresses we developed a few years ago that use a shape memory alloy called nitinol. And the dresses move on the body and open and close and basically behave almost like an organic parasite that lives on your body and inhabits your body.
Hal Myers, can you give us a similar thumbnail description of biofeedback and neurofeedback? And how would you see it applied to Joanna Brzezowska's work?
Biofeedback is simply the process of monitoring any physiological signal in the body and feeding it back to the individual who's producing the signal. And there's two sections, it's divided into two areas, neurofeedback and biofeedback. Neurofeedback focuses on the brain and biofeedback more on the peripheral physiology such as sweat gland activity, temperature, respiration, heart rate, muscle tension. And most of the time this is used for relaxation or coping with stress. Muscle feedback is used for rehabilitation. So someone who's had a stroke, for example, can learn to enhance very, very small signals from an area that's paralyzed, for example. Or for incontinence, we can teach people to strengthen the pelvic muscles by giving them a feedback on very, very small signals. The neurofeedback is generally used for attention deficit disorder and head trauma and also for peak performance, which is an area that we focused on a lot. We set up what's called the Mind Room at AC Milan and Chelsea soccer teams in Europe. And it's basically 11 of our systems with 11 computers and 11 chairs where the players actually sit in the chairs and they get feedback on their performance and their physiological responses to the performance. And so it teaches them how to perform under stress. Vancouver Canucks just put in a system last year, and they're doing very well right now. We hope they're going to win. And we hope we can attribute it to our biofeedback system.
And Skate Canada used it during the Olympics and did very, very well with it. They attribute, it's basically getting inside using visualization and understanding. Like, for example, in speed skating, when you get a false start, you have to start again. To get your head back into that state again, mm-hmm. over and over again, is very difficult.
Instant focus.
And you're talking about, you know, a hundredth to a thousandth of a second that you can lose by.
Yeah.
In terms of wearability, we've done several projects. There's one fellow named Jordan Dietcher who got an actress to act on stage and dance and all, and she was monitored by our physiological monitoring equipment, and all the lights and the sounds changed around them. And we've also got the cave at McGill where they're using it with virtual reality environment, which changes with your emotions and all. We've been talking also to Hydro-Québec about monitoring the physiology of line workers because they find that with stress they actually make mistakes and get themselves killed. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of more practical applications. I've always been interested in art, and I've developed a lot of interactive light sculptures and things over the years, and I'm excited by what Joanna does. And I'm not exactly sure what we can do together, but I think it's time we start working together again.
And what's interesting is my original point of entry into electronic textiles was through the field of HCI, which is human-computer interaction. And I remember 15 years ago when I was at MIT talking to pioneers such as Steve Mann, who's now a professor at University of Toronto, and he would come into my office and say, look at my wearable computer.
And he was wearing our equipment. That was our FlexComp system.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the ProComp Infinity FlexComp, yeah.
But so my initial reaction, I would look at him and my initial reaction was, how can you call that wearable? Because they were these
it was a 12-volt battery.
Yeah. it was huge, hard containers, boxes strapped to his body. Yeah. Huge helmets supporting a camera that he was wearing at the time. So my point of entry into electronic textiles was actually trying to make these kinds of things more wearable,
right,
by making them softer, helping them conform to the human body, making them more wearable in the same way that a silk shirt is wearable. It's comfortable, it breathes, right. It allows you to almost forget that you're wearing a piece of clothing, right? And this is certainly some of the discussions we had 5-6 years ago. How can we make these sensors that can be cumbersome still to some degree, although they are becoming more and more ergonomic, mm-hmm. how can we make them as invisible as the clothing that we wear?
Well, we're in the process of developing a replacement for our main unit, which is much smaller. It's the size of an iPhone-ish, and it'll have up to 8 to 10 channels of data. So it'd be very small enough to be able to put in like a little pocket or attach to a garment. But of course, the making a garment that can attach the signals, the sensors to you easily is always a challenge. I mean, you've got the polar heart rate monitors, which, you know, it's a strap that goes around. People don't really like putting those things on. And then there's Sensatex, I think, is a company that's got a garment that's sort of tight fitting. Is it? I don't know if it's nylon or some kind of material. And it's got sensors built into it. And we're looking at something in that area. There's several companies been around doing this. And it's a company called Vivometrics is another one. They're using it often in the drug industry, for example, to look at adverse reactions to drugs or, you know, how you react to drugs, and also in the advertising industry to see
how you react to movies or to commercials or whatever, or their ads that they're putting together. But we're also still very interested in the sports area, and of course, the lighter, easier to put on, the better. And of course, there's the area of safety, which I mentioned Hydro-Québec, but firemen, anybody else who wants to be monitored. So we're looking at those areas, and we're still saying, well, what can we use to monitor this? So this is where the crossover can come in, aside from the artistic part, which I'm really interested in.
Yeah, but also on the technical end of things, what I find fascinating is how to attach hard components to soft components,
right?
How to consider wearability and industrial design and garment design all as part of one process, right?
Right.
So I'm very intrigued and very kind of excited by some of these questions of how to best attach hard components to soft components, how to make them invisible on the body.
It seems to me some of those applications you're talking about high-performance sports, and Joanna, the direction you're bringing it from is more wearable stuff sort of all the time, not just under specialized circumstances. So I guess you're talking about entering sort of the consumer market, or anybody can wear it, or at any time. It doesn't have to be for therapy, or it doesn't have to be for high performance sports.
Right.
That's the ultimate goal, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting if you can sort of show your heart on your sleeve, literally.
So I mean, as you get stressed, I mean, you walk into, you know, a restaurant or a bar or something like that, and you see the person's response to you instantly. I don't know how much people are going to like that, but there's some very interesting apps out now that can use facial recognition. If you haven't learned how to do it yourself, it can do it and tell you whether or not the person's interested. Hopefully, you've learned that skill on your own. But certainly, you could have a simple ear clip that you pick up your heart rate and then transmit that to your clothing, or, you know, a couple of EKG
electrodes built into the shirt, which is easier, and something that's picking up on your respiration and perhaps sweat gland activity.
Yeah.
Loads of options.
And there's a lot of great performance pieces and artwork that's actually done based on the biofeedback signals received from dancers, from performers.
Yeah.
So we've mostly been working with sensing outside the body so far. So we've made these large sensing tapestries that sense, have capacitive sensors that sense proximity of the human body to the tapestry. But it could be very interesting to couple that with more personal information coming from the performers. So on one hand, the performers could actually be manipulating the external space by approaching this tapestry and moving away from it. But at the same time, their own biofeedback data could be affecting other parts of the performance, either the sound, the lighting in the room, the way that the music is performed.
I often thought, I mean, I remember years and years ago thinking, wouldn't it be interesting if you had either two people or one person where they'd be monitoring, they'd be wearing a brainwave monitor, and their dominant brainwave frequency would be transmitted in a specific color on the wall by a projector. And this is before the days of projectors and all that. I was thinking of light bulbs and all. And it'd be wireless, and this is all doable now. So as you walk in the room, your color would light up your side of the room, and your color, and then you, as you get into sync, your colors would start to match as your brain waves start to, you know, get together. Or as you get into coherence in your own brain, you know, the colors would match, showing that you're using both the left and right side of your brain. Those are kind of, that would be some kind of a fun thing to do also.
Yeah.
You could do that with just a couple of sensors on the head and one ear clip on the ear. Relatively straightforward.
And you can manipulate your thought patterns to change the colors?
Well, that's the whole idea about biofeedback, is that you can, like, for example, kids with attention deficit learn to suppress the slow wave kind of sleepy activity, the alpha theta, and to enhance what's called the sensory motor rhythm activity, which is about 15 to 18 hertz. And then they just pay attention. But it takes about 30 or 40 sessions, just like, you know, learning to play an instrument. You need to do something at least 30 times or get a habit. And the brain just starts to rewire itself. So he doesn't have to say, now I'm going to pay attention. He just does. And it really works that way. But you can manipulate it quite easily.
It sounds like a project for you, Joanna, to integrate some of this. Especially, I mean, in fine arts and I guess in the performance area as well.
Yeah.
People seem divided about technology. You're both come from technology backgrounds, but some people fear technology or are uncomfortable with technology. What are your own views? I mean, you're integrating it with people's bodies. What are all your own views in a sort of a higher sense about technology?
I mean, technology is inevitable, right? It's on one hand, it's inevitable just because we constantly want to strive to improve things, to make things faster, smaller, easier. To make instruments easier to play, to make it easier to create artworks, you know, coming from my perspective, the arts. And that's not necessarily something that can be called good or bad. You know, it is inevitable. It would be unfortunate if these new technologies were to completely replace older technologies. Musical instruments are technologies. They're just older technologies. Same with, for instance, textiles, right? It would be unfortunate if electronic textiles were to completely replace more traditional textile technologies. So my hope is that technologies from the past and technologies from the present and from the future can coexist and, in fact, help to create a more complex and a richer world.
Yeah, from my perspective, the first thing I was interested in when I was a kid was photography, and I had a dark room, and I was president of the photography clubs, and then I got into metal sculpting. And so I've always loved art, but I've also really loved technology. I've liked to learn how to control and manipulate the world. Maybe it was because I felt that I had to. But so I've learned to do all that stuff, but I've always enjoyed the artistic part of technology. So I, from my perspective, I don't want to lose it, and we design our products to be aesthetic. And I think that I agree with Joanna that we can't stop it, and people are embracing it like crazy. I mean, the way that they share their information on Facebook and Twitter just amazes me. I won't do it, and not to that extent.
I have like 200 photos of my new dog on Facebook.
But the question is whether, you know, how far do you go with yourself? Like the people who have the head cams and walk around all day long with, you know, showing what's happening in their own personal world. It's, you know, it gets to some extreme. And but I went to something called Singularity University Executive Training Course, and that's run by Ray Kurzweil, brilliant guy. And there were 40 of us there. And
did you go this year?
I went last year, last February. And I mean, it's one of the best things I've ever done. Mm. It was all about future technology and exponential change. The idea that, what, you know, if you think from now, if 10 years from now, it's going to be 10 times as much knowledge. It's more like, what's that, 1,024 times
as much. It's accelerating, right?
Geometric. One of our projects near the end, after going learning about all these amazing technologies and hanging around IDEO Design Studio and all, was to come up with a project. We broke into groups. Of course, my interest was in monitoring your physiology and what could you do in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now. And so in 15 years, you could actually have something that's basically almost built in and maybe be under the skin that's monitoring your physiology at all time. It's transmitting it to doctors and to a knowledge base. Like we've just seen that Watson, the IBM computer that beat Jeopardy. I was just reading yesterday that they're loading it up with a database of medical knowledge, and it's already really accurate. It's even more accurate than most doctors because it's getting fed in every single day. It's getting information. Wow. And their goal within the next 2 years is that this will be the place the doctor goes to find out the information. So that can probably all be downloaded. Well, you'll have instant access to the internet anyway, but it could be downloaded every morning. And so you could be checking your blood glucose and all the other parameters in your EKG and alerting whoever it is, or even having a pill that gives you the digitalis or the nitro or whatever it is that you need at that moment built into the whole system. And the other part was some kind of a morphing skin on a robot companion, which would be really, you know, that could turn into your wife, to Tiger Woods, or to whatever you're interested in, and would
turn your wife into Tiger Woods.
That's the dream of every guy, I guess. But the idea is that, gee, I feel like playing golf today. Oh, hi, I'm Tiger. I just, you know, and so with the ability to have, you know, textile or a skin, a synthetic skin, they can change and morph the face and all into something else. So, you know, in 10 years or 15 years, you can imagine that all will be possible at the rate of change that we're seeing in technology. So I don't think we can escape it.
Yeah. One of the new projects that I'm developing right now, which I've been doing this actually for 3 years already, I still call it new, but it's in its third year. We've received quite a lot of funding with my collaborator Maxime Scuro-Bogatti at the Polytechnique at the Université de Montréal to actually try and move some of the functionality that I am interested in, so shape change, color change, energy generation, trying to move that directly into the fiber itself. So we've been developing fibers that can change color, fibers that can generate very small amounts of electricity, fibers that are basically batteries. Again, you know, still quite inefficient, still very much in the lab, but we're getting very promising results.
Have you been working with nanotechnology at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, some of what Maxime does basically works because it becomes at the nanoscale. He works with drawing huge chunks of polymers to very small scale, so then the different materials do interact at the nanoscale. But another thing I wanted to mention in response to the question about sort of the ethical implications of technology, right? Since I'm based in the Faculty of Fine Arts, one of the things that I do, both in my research lab and in my teaching, and just in how I tend to speak about these issues, is to
to not only talk about using technology, but also talk about how people misuse technology, and not misuse in the sense that it's wrong, but perhaps misuse it in order to reveal certain qualities that those different technologies might have that aren't easy to perceive, perhaps, right? So a lot of artwork, a lot of the even design work that we do tries to really kind of find these fine borders between use and misuse, so as to open up questions, so as to actually interrogate these technologies. So when you look at some of our projects, even some of the very simple early projects, like the skirt we made that has touch sensors embedded in it, and when somebody touches you, parts of the embroidery illuminate to show how long it's been since somebody touched you or how hard they touched you. On one hand, you know, you could think of very useful applications, such as if people are being groped in the subway, you know, that the skirt will alert the authorities, you know, you've been groped, there's been unwanted touch. You know, so you can think of it in terms of security, in terms of safety, but you can also start asking questions about privacy, for instance, mm-hmm. right? Do I want people to know I've been touched? You can start asking questions about control over that information. Because once, and not just control in the political sense, but also control in terms of legislative questions, right? And do I want to reveal? How much do I want to reveal? How do I control it as the individual? Who actually owns it? Is it your company, Hal, right? Once you sell these sensors, are you actually keeping track of all of the data that those sensors generate in some gigantic database?
Not yet. We haven't considered that one yet. It's always possible, I suppose.
It's a reasonable question.
So one of the things that I'm interested in being in the Faculty of Fine Arts is actually using and misusing and creating examples of work using cutting-edge technologies that actually reveal some of the underlying tensions, some of the underlying questions, possible difficulties inherent in deploying these technologies.
And one example would be, if we were monitoring someone full-time, where does that data go to? Because
Exactly.
Insurance companies would like to know if
no
you have
kidding.
Some underlying problem so that they can cut you off.
Or if you're smoking in the closet, right, secret.
Basically, they can use that as one of the parameters for what they charge you or whether they cut you off from your insurance, and that's just one example. So that's one of the problems with people. For example, the DNA testing that they've come up with, 23andMe and a few of the other ones, once you show that you've got a susceptibility to bladder cancer or prostate cancer or whatever, the insurance companies get their hands on that and they think,
why would they insure you?
Yeah, exactly. So and people are sharing all this information out on Facebook and I'm sure the insurance companies are looking. So it is a big question.
It's fascinating.
So if you're being monitored and you're giving out all this information about yourself, I guess you got to be aware that not everybody out there are good guys.
I wonder how much of that is generational too, because it seems to me some younger people, I'm thinking of my kids actually, who are late adolescents, early 20s, who grew up with technology, are seen less exercised by privacy and notions of personal agency because they grew up with this presence, whereas some of the older people are a little bit taken aback.
Well, there's probably a little bit of naivety there because we do know that the food industry, look how they manipulate children, and the agriculture industry. I mean, they're out for themselves, and so are the insurance companies and the government, everybody else. I mean, you think it's for you, but it's not a political discussion. It just is, what do you do with the data? And it that is a good question. Now, if you're keeping yours local, like on your dress and all that, then you can decide whether you want to turn it on or off. And I mean, I think it's fascinating as a fashion statement and as an interesting way into your emotions if you're actually looking at physiology.
There's also interesting approaches to thinking about business models for fashion. So a lot of people often ask me, now that we have garments that can change color, that can change shape, does that mean you only have one dress for the rest of your life? and it will just adapt.
Your wedding dress will suddenly get much longer and grow a tail.
Or perhaps, you'll walk into Ogilvy's and just download software into your garment take on the new pattern.
It's a shapeshifter.
The new colors, right?
Yeah.
On one hand, working with technology, with electronic technology, we both know that that's very improbable, right? That, in fact, we'll be replacing them even more often as the new versions come out and we'll want to upgrade every time.
Well, you know what's really interesting? One of the presenters at Singularity was talking about future manufacturing, where you would start off with the atoms And then it would just assemble the atoms into transistors and into diodes and into plastic and into, and you'd say, okay, I want a computer, and it would, it's got the instructions and all of that comes the computer or a dress or whatever. So it is conceivable it'll end up being a software world where you'd pay for your software and then you'd create whatever, and then you're going to be in the same model of people ripping off your software and making, but you know, people make copies of dresses all the time.
So you're downloading your dress.
You download your dress. You'll have your personal, what do you call it?
Fabricator.
And like they're doing right now. I mean, we've been using one for cost about $10,000. You can turn out little plastic models.
Yeah.
Just from a drawing, and it's really good, really accurate.
Joanna Brzezowska, you were talking a little bit before about working on the. Not even textiles, the level of fibers. So it seems to me it's beyond garments or textiles. I mean, these could have a lot more applications or potential uses.
So I'll just repeat once again, you know, my point of entry into all of this is softness. And that is why my research lab is called Extra Soft Labs. And I'm just so interested and almost obsessed, I suppose, with trying to make electronics and new technologies more conformable, more soft, and just more wearable in the sense that they can interact with the human body in this soft way. So that's one of the reasons I'm really interested in developing new fibers. On the other hand, just from a technical assembly point of view, some of the highest points of failure in my own work have been at the intersection or the point, the joining between the hard elements, the hard components, and then the soft components. That is often, you know, the point of failure. So again, by moving some of the functionality into the fiber itself, we would circumvent those technical difficulties. What's really interesting to me about trying to make these technical fibers is also a whole new area of research that's being opened up right now that I've been talking about and running workshops with some of my colleagues from MIT about programming the material world, right? So the old model of working with electronic technology is that perhaps you build a physical model, let's say a little robot train or a robot killer robot that walks and smashes things. And then you program your electronics and then you attach your electronics to this physical artifact, right? So more and more now with some of these incredible new materials and coming from material science, some of these incredible new materials that we're working with, you can actually talk about programming the material world where you'll have a fiber. The fiber, let's say, is a capacitor. By cutting it, the capacitance changes, right? Mm-hmm. By having a different length of fiber. Working with, let's say, a flat sheet that is a battery by cutting a shape into it. So again, you know, I'm a designer. By cutting a little rose, the charge in the battery is different. So in effect, we're programming physical materials by changing their shape, by manipulating them. I'm so interested in using technical fibers and through a process of weaving them or knitting them, in fact, programming a larger system. So there's concepts of emergence embedded in this, concepts of complexity, right?
It's a network. Mm. When it's knitted, it seems to me.
But also complexity, because you can put two very simple things together and they will affect each other's behavior in complex and unpredictable ways, right? And of course, these fibers could be applied in, just to bring the discussion back to a more tangible level, these fibers could be embedded in all kinds of things in our environment, not just garments, but furniture, you know, the carpets, chairs, etc. So each time you sit on your chair and you're moving around, as some of us do, you're actually generating electricity. Each time you walk on the carpet, perhaps you would be helping to generate some of the power to light the room. So yes, I agree with you. There are millions and billions of exciting possibilities that will come from what we call fiber scale functionality.
But you know, what you're suggesting, sitting in a chair generating electricity through maybe the piezo effect or something like that, you could also pick up heart rate that way.
Yeah.
You know, just some of the ballistics of the heart, you can pick it up quite easily in the back of a chair or on the seat of a chair. So you can mix in your physiology at the same time without actually having to make any contact with the body. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of fun things to look at.
I'm interested too in the sort of the gender implications of what you're talking about, because Traditionally, fibers and fabrics, textiles have been sort of woman's work, you know, to put that in quotations. And it's highly unlikely that a male researcher would have. There are some now, but you're bringing a different perspective on some of these technology issues through textiles.
Gender issues are really important in my work, more on the pedagogical side, insofar as it's an interesting entry point to have women become interested in programming and electronic technologies, etc. And there's some wonderful researchers whose work really focuses solely on that, such as Leah Buckley from MIT, from the MIT Media Lab, that I work with as well, whose kind of core research interest is how to build these electronics toolkits and these pedagogical initiatives that are focused on women, not exclusively, but often on women, and building interest and love of electronics and new technologies through these forms that are traditionally more feminine, at least in our culture.
That's a good idea.
Myers, what about you? You know, you're almost solely technology. Do you get a lot of women working in your shop?
Actually, we're finding, I think they're graduating as many or more electrical engineers these days. Women are really interested in the area. And in our company, we're the United Nations. We've got somebody from everywhere. And in engineering, we've got a few more males, but we definitely have females working there, and it's great. There's definitely an interest. I think that barrier has been broken well.
Mm-hmm. Joanna, do you, is any of your work in partnership with industry or with, I know you've done some work with fashion designers, but are there any other kind of partnerships that support your work?
I'm very much involved in the cultural industries these days. I mean, I did work for the military more in the US before coming here, actually only in the US. Where we're doing working for military subcontractors to develop things like woven antenna in the uniform to help have a greater reach of whatever communication signal that the soldier needed to have. We tried to embed, again, capacitive sensing in uniforms to help detect any other bodies of water, meaning human bodies, in close proximity.
Bodies of water.
Well, do you know about the fiber optic one? They're actually putting fibers all the way down to the arms and legs and areas so they know if someone's been shot.
Yeah.
Because they'll tell where the fiber has been broken. They can see the light didn't get through.
Yeah, so that's an idea that's been around for about 20 years.
It's been around for a long time. Somebody's actually doing it, I think.
The group from Georgia Tech actually developed a wearable motherboard about 15 years ago already, I think. And it was, it's such a chilling application to think about. It's called medical triage in the field,
exactly.
Right? So that's how you make it sound clean. But basically medical triage in the field where, if the wound is located in the arm of a soldier, they might send somebody to rescue him. But if it's close to the heart, they just leave him.
Remote diagnosing, basically.
Well, it's more for triage to see if it's worth sending a team or not. If the person is, not going to make it, they abandon them. So it's a very chilling application to think about. But there's like this wearable motherboard that they developed at Georgia Tech was mostly, I think, supposed to track the health and well-being of soldiers in the field. Yeah. So I was involved with some military consulting, with developing some prototypes for military subcontractors when I was in the U.S. But since I've been in Canada, I'm mostly funded by bodies such as SHRC, NSERC. Actually, I've been funded by everything that exists. NSERC, SHRC, Canada Council, Canadian Heritage, etc., which has allowed me to really remain in these more cultural industries, so to develop work that can be shown on stage, that can be shown in museums, published in art books, as well as, I also do some publishing that is more in scientific journals and conferences, etc. The way that I help contribute to new product development is really, again, through my students, through pedagogy. So a lot of the students who worked with me, who worked in my research lab, who studied with me, have now started really exciting companies. You know, my husband always yells at me because he's telling me, why aren't you making the money? You know, I could retire. Why don't you start a company? But it's just not what I'm good at. You know, I had a company in Boston and it was just constant pain and stress every day. So I'm quite happy actually just passing on the knowledge and inspiring students to go and develop interesting products.
And you keep your independence.
I keep my independence. I get to brag about my students. You know, I take credit for part of their formation. But I'm just not a businesswoman, it turns out.
Well, that's a good partnership between universities and industry, I would think. I mean, it turned out well-trained students and Hal Myers, you hire them.
Which we actually have one of her students working for us right now. He's an industrial designer.
A good student, I
He's very good, actually. Very ingenious, really interesting guy.
Great. Joanna Brzezowska, Hal Myers, thank you for joining us today.